Welcome to Transformers, the podcast about how business people and policymakers are creating a sustainable future. I'm your host, Kai Embren. My guest today is Tom Kerr, lead climate specialist at the World Bank. Tom works with South Asian nations to tackle climate change through bold policies like decarbonization strategies and climate finance. A global leader in the climate innovation, Tom founded the Carbon Pricing Leadership Coalition at COP21, driving worldwide action. With a career spanning from the World Economic Forum, the International Energy Agency, and US EPA, he's been shaping climate solutions for many years. Let's dive into his incredible journey and impact. Welcome, Tom. Great to have you as a guest in Transformers.
Glad to be here, Kai.
And today's talk will focus on green and climate finance, mostly related to mitigation and adaptation. So, Tom, even if you're not an expert on the role of municipalities at the World Bank, accessing green and climate finance remains a significant challenge for cities, often due to a limited capacity among local officials. Do you have any experience of this need to bridge training and expertise gap to ensure cities to so they can secure the funds they need?
Yes, absolutely, Kai. I mean, I think as a World Bank group, you know, we have many different sort of tools in the toolkit for the clients that we operate in. And so being at the World Bank, which is the public arm of the bank, we work with governments of all sorts. So we work at the national level, at the state level, but also very much at the local level. And I think increasingly at the local level, particularly in the larger middle income countries where we, you know, have very active programs on the mitigation and adaptation side for climate change. I think here, you know, there's a lot of, as you say, depending on the country and the context, there's a broad spectrum of capacity, of data availability, of modeling and resource availability as well. Often there's sometimes the role we play is often to link between the different levels of government and make sure they're talking to one another. You know, there are action plans that are prepared at a national level and they don't always trickle down with resources and guidance to the subnational entities. And so we sometimes help with that. But I think, you know, we really try to take a holistic approach and work at the sort of suite of systems at the national, subnational levels. And I think, you know, a lot of the projects involve direct loans. Part of the loan, you know, it isn't just sort of giving them a blank check. It has very specific sort of check-ins around capacity and sort of building some databases and building sort of resources. So maybe the easiest way to give you is an example that, you know, I work in South Asia and we work with the local governments in Kerala state in India. In 2018, they had a pretty bad coastal storm that was caused, you know, obviously the evidence was very clear because of climate change. And, you know, oftentimes we are one of the first responders that comes in to help the government sort of clean up after a storm like that and figure out, you know, how do you rebuild the roads, you know, connections to communities and make sure that people are getting the services they need. But then we do come in very much with a sort of resilience lens. And so when we start to build back and give them loans and support, we offer them guidance around, you know, it's not just, you know, let's build the exact same thing that was there before, but how do we, you know, what are the sort of future risks? And we present some of the modeling and data and we help to build their capacity as well as forecasting these risks and doing early warning systems and providing other sorts of support. So then the next time it hits, they're not really calling on us anymore. They have the resilience to respond. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing that happens there is you build the trust and we've gone, for example, in that Kerala project, it was really started just with coastal resilience, but then we started diversifying after we gained the trust and we built up some of the resources there and we're able to build, you know, expand that to even some of the low carbon solutions they were starting to look at. Now that they had the resource base and they had some of the people that were trained in looking at this, they started to say, well, okay, now I think we've gotten some of the resilience built back, but what about low carbon? You know, we kind of would see ourselves as a green hub of innovation in the country. And so now we're actually looking at low carbon pathways and things like solid waste and e-vehicles and things like that. So
it means also a lot of connection between different types of stakeholders. Local government sometimes are used to work very indoors, and to find solutions is mostly nowadays gathering with other types of stakeholders. Do you have experience of that?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think, as you say, I mean, I also have a lot of experience with the private sector, and we see a lot more, especially in the middle income countries like India, a lot more private sector engagement and know-how and interest in sort of seeing, they see the risks as well in their supply chains. They're interested in contributing to resilience, but also then seeing opportunities where they can invest in the low carbon solutions. I think that's a key stakeholder for sure. Yeah.
You mentioned innovation, and what sort of innovative approaches is the World Bank exploring to unlock local sources of finance, such as green bonds or community-based funding?
Yeah, I think on the local front, there are quite a few options. One of the things I like to talk about is, you may have heard of, you know, people talk about voluntary carbon markets or results-based financing, it's often called. We're seeing a group of investors that are looking to place resources, and they and I think when you have that kind of upfront capital, it really, that's one of the biggest barriers to projects. You know, if you're a developer and you're trying to raise capital for a project, you often are, you know, people will give you a small grant or technical assistance, but they won't kind of pre-finance the project. So what results-based finance does is it allows you to estimate what the emissions reductions might be from a project, and then apply a carbon price based on, you know, negotiations and market considerations. And then that money provides that upfront capital for developers. And so we actually did the world's first carbon bond, which is this results-based payment sort of thing, in Vietnam about a year and a half or 2 years ago, it was a local project at a school, and they had sort of a fossil-based water treatment facility that was getting old and needed to be replaced, and they wanted to replace it with a solar-based system. And so we helped them to calculate, you know, the World Bank has many of experts kind of looking at these carbon calculations. And so we provided the credibility of, okay, if you swap this out, what would the carbon benefits be? But then interestingly, the global bank, Citibank, came in and said, okay, we want to be part of, we would pay this much for carbon, and we'll set a guarantee a carbon price. And then we issued a bond, our World Bank Treasury issued this carbon bond. And some international investors, I think from Europe, Danish and perhaps Dutch investors came in and bought the bond and then provided that upfront capital. And so now that project is operational. So that's one example of innovative finance. Yeah. You mentioned green bonds, and I think the World Bank has been a leader in trying to do this. And there, as you probably know, there, you know, green bonds have expanded to many different types of issuers, you know, corporates and sovereigns, and then, as you say, local governments. We are seeing, you know, that it is, the first thing is really to build the capacity at the local government to be able to measure and monitor what are these impacts and how do you report on that, because the investors really want that. And there is a good deal of handholding and capacity building that's needed there. And also just to identify for them which projects they kind of want to ring fence and put into that bond. But then also we do see that, you know, that one of the biggest challenges that we hear about this greenium, which is a bit of a premium that investors are providing for green, and that it's not always materializing depending on the types of project. And so we have to help them access the market and find the right investors and do a little bit of matchmaking there as well.
Well, I have observed a significant gap in the raising capital for mitigation and adaptation programs when I have been working with local governments. But recently, I inquired World Bank about ICLEI's capacity building and training program on green climate finance. Mm-hmm. But I have not received any feedback. In this context, could you clarify whether the World Bank prioritizes its approach to local governments? And if so, how is it aligns with the World Bank's overall policy on green climate finance?
Yeah, I mean, I think as I said before, we try to look at all sorts of mitigation options, and then I think as you depending on the size of the country, you really have to. You can't always work with the national government. In fact, you may have a lot more traction with the local governments. And so we have a whole urban team that's working on green climate finance and trying to help to raise capacity. And sometimes it's just as I say, it's not even green finance. It's just raising finance capacity and sort of ability to be attractive to the private sector, to have capital markets. A lot of this is new for a lot of the especially the poor countries you're operating in. And so there's a spectrum of sort of availability we have, but we are certainly pushing a lot of the sort of climate smart urban solutions. You have the mitigation solutions, as sort of methane capture from wastewater or from landfills. You have, green buildings, green urban buildings. You have renewable energy and green vehicles is a big, big area. But then on the resilience side, we're seeing a lot more requests for things like, thermal comfort and cooling as places face the heat, the extreme heat, especially where I work in Asia, but also on, coastal resilience and urban flooding. And so that's we have to come up with new tools and resources to address those problems.
Do you think that the local level are going to play a more important role of deliveries for solutions?
Yes, I think as we switch from mitigation more to adaptation, and we see a lot of the, that's really, they're on the front lines. The local governments are really on the front lines for the impacts of climate change. And so we definitely have to redouble efforts to build up adaptation and resilience capacity and finance for these sorts of things to the local level.
Let's talk a little bit more about the private sector's engagement, because it's critical for scaling climate finance. How is the World Bank fostering partnership with private investors to mobilize necessary capital for climate mitigation and adaptation efforts?
Yeah, there's a ton of work here. I think we do see help us access international climate finance. And of course, we are here to do that. And we try to help them sort through, where are the most attractive projects, where are the pots of money that are available. But oftentimes that concessional finance at the international level is only sort of smaller amount that can be used catalytically. And then we try to look with governments at their national, what we might call domestic resource mobilization. So, you're in a country and you can bring in some international climate finance from a donor or like a group like the World Bank. But you also want to be looking at how do you use your domestic resources. A lot of bigger and smaller governments have their own development finance agencies, their own public finance, their spending. And so how do they target that money to, again, attract the private sector? And then also look at, then the private sector side. I've been in this space long enough to see, there's been dramatic changes in sort of profitability and attractiveness for different technologies. And so it requires kind of a rolling up your sleeves and really a talking to the market actors, the private players, finance providers and the solutions providers at a country level to understand like where are the market dynamics right now? Typically, we see solar being the lowest cost new power source and nearly across the world. So the technology cost is not high, but then the cost of finance tends to be high because there's this perception of risk with the financial community about these technologies, based on various factors. And so that's what we really try to focus is how do we use some of that concessional finance then to draw down that risk perception? You can do things like first loss guarantees or blended finance or concessional finance. Sometimes they need upfront technical assistance, and that can be used in that way. And so you're kind of like, it's using a suite of tools, international climate finance, this results-based finance I mentioned earlier can be catalytic as well. And then also really getting very specific with, which sectors and which solutions need a larger injection of public finance and which ones really maybe don't need a subsidy, additional finance, but they might need, a public policy change or something to unlock more finance. So like an example there is in India. We have a lot of solar resource and they've had a dramatic growth in solar the past decade or so. I think they're now the world's fourth or fifth largest solar market. But there's an issue around things like land access, or access to the grid. And they're not really related to policy or to finance. It's not a subsidy that's required, but it's related to a policy change that when an investor sees the policy switch, then they become much more comfortable with that and the cost of finance comes down.
You with so much of experience from many years working in the field of climate strategies, both in Europe and Asia, as you said now, and also from US perspective. And how do you see the private sector's engagement? How has it changed through the years?
No, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, I would say that, you know, up until the Paris Agreement, it was largely seen climate change is sort of a global, you know, commons problem, and there's the governments are leading on this, and we're here to kind of support, tell us what to do, kind of, you know, it's more of like we're waiting for the right sort of policy frameworks. And I think, you know, then you started to see, I think we did a study actually a year and a half ago that might be of interest to folks. I, given the fact that I've been doing this for a while, I started to think, you know, we've been actually doing policymaking for climate change since, you know, probably the 70s or 80s. So we've had a few decades of experience. You know, what has worked? You know, where have we seen policies come in place? And then you've seen the private investment flow. And so we ended up looking at successful policy implementation across all sorts of mitigation solutions. So everything from gas flaring and methane or renewable energy, e-vehicles, even things like fossil fuel subsidy reform or carbon pricing. And we did a series of 25 case studies, and it was called Reality Check, kind of to say like, okay, we, you know, where, what are the elements of successful policy? I think over the years, there's been over 4,000 climate policies, and a lot of times they tend to be very targeted sectoral policies, and they aren't sort of an umbrella climate framework law or things like that. But then we started to see an evolution from these really strategic sort of interventions to a more economy-wide approach. And I think that's what we advocate, is that you have to build these policies on top of one another. And when you start to see that, then you do see, you know, like if you there's been several case studies where you look at the global solar market, where, you know, Japan and Germany and some of the earlier countries came in and heavily subsidized and kind of gave them market access. And then, you know, then we've all seen what followed, you know, and like I mentioned with India, I mean, when I worked at the International Energy Agency in 2010 or so, I think India wasn't anywhere on the map. And then now today they're the fourth largest market, and they saw this opportunity because the costs were coming down, and they put a national solar mission in place. They put in sort of carrots and sticks around, you know, okay, here is an incentive for these purchases, but then also here are some mandates, you know, utilities have to buy a certain percentage of their power. And so altogether, these sorts of policies, you know, create a feedback loop, and now the technologies are very competitive in a lot of cases. And I think then it gets to my point earlier, which is, you know, if the technology is really the cheapest in the market, then what's preventing it from gaining greater market share? And a lot of time in some of the emerging markets, it gets down to some of these the cost of finance and some of the perception of risk, whether it's a new technology or a new business model.
So is the conclusion that the private sector's engagements have increased through the years?
Yeah, I think as a result of these policy frameworks, we've definitely seen this. I mean, I know I did a study at the International Finance Corporation in 2016 called the Climate Investment Opportunity Report. And that was really kind of on this wave of, you know, this is not just a government problem anymore. This is actually a private investment opportunity, but you need to get some of these policies right.
Let's talk about the weather. In 2023, the Swiss Re Sigma report estimated that the economic losses from natural catastrophes reached $280 billion, meaning that 62% of the global losses were uninsured. With the rising weather-related catastrophes, innovative finance mechanisms like parametric insurance and catastrophic cat bonds are gaining attention. Can you briefly explain how these tools work and their role helping countries to manage disastrous risks? What is the World Bank doing? And has
absolutely
done?
This is a huge area. You know, as you say, the impacts are growing, and we have to both provide the immediate relief and sort of financing, and then also, you know, start to lay the framework from not just building back, but building back with more resilience. So there's, you know, climate, as you mentioned, climate and disaster risk insurance is a proven instrument that we've seen in many, many governments and many countries. We also work with governments to kind of put together sovereign disaster risk financing that includes the mobilization of funds immediately following disasters to have them ready. And we help them to do sort of what we call adaptation and resilience screening. So they know, you know, depending on where they are in the world, you know, they have to be prepared for, you know, the coastal storm states have to worry about that. Some of the states, you know, the countries that are in the region of the world I work in the Middle East and South Asia, have to be ready for extreme heat and urban flooding and some of the cities that are on coastal. So we provide that sort of mapping for them. And then we try to estimate what is the disaster risk financing you should have in place to be prepared. But then even that, you know, there's still going to be other, you know, events that happen that are difficult to respond to. And so then we do have, you know, key instruments like catastrophe bonds or what we call CAT bonds, as well as is something the World Bank calls the CAT DDO, which is a deferred drawdown option that helps governments secure funds before a disaster and helps to finance this sort of emergency response.
Okay, can you explain a little bit more about how does it look, this type of catastrophic CAT bonds?
It works with the government to identify what their risks are and what the sort of amount of fiscal set aside they should have. And then we provide this secured amount before the disaster hits. When they know, let's say a big storm is coming, we allow this early payment and it's a very rapid sort of approval. So then they can be prepared and respond before the actual event happens. And then we help to come in afterwards. And I know it's one of the key tools that we have in our toolkit for helping countries to prepare and respond.
And for example, interest in South Asia about this type of insurance solutions?
Yes, absolutely. I know we're doing this in a few of the countries for sure. And I think there's some other ones in the pipeline.
Let's go back to India again. And you've been working in South Asia for a time. And what actions is the World Bank promoting to address extreme heat in South Asia?
Yeah, as you say, I mean, this is a really, you know, urgent need, and it's getting worse every year. And I think that the good news is that India in particular is being a sort of a leader in this space. They have a India Cooling Action Plan, or ICAP, they put in place a few years back. It's one of the few, I think there's a handful of governments that have done this now. And it identifies, you know, there are actions that sort of what you call in different buckets. So one is active cooling. So obviously this is a technology-based approach where you're trying to put in place in buildings and in urban settings, you know, what is the best, you know, cooling equipment that, because, you know, as you probably can, you know, it's logical that as you put in more equipment that consumes more energy, that's going to exacerbate the climate problem. And so you have to have these be very efficient and sort of targeted technologies that meet certain criteria. And so we're helping the government to figure out what those technologies might be. And they run the spectrum from, you know, what we see in the West of, you know, usual air conditioning, a central air or other units, but then also down to the lower tech, like even ceiling, very efficient ceiling fans. And depending on the setting, you know, we help them to figure out with the building's structure and how that can be provided. So there's the active cooling bit. There's the passive cooling bit as well, which is getting into the design of buildings and cities and figuring out how do you, you know, avoid the heat load in the first place by building things with such as reflective roofs or with tree cover, but also air pass through and other sorts of things, which often are traditional technologies that are just not, they get forgotten about as people, you know, get into the modern age. But then we try to, you know, bring that back into the training with architects and designers of cities and bring that in. Another element is actually not always logical, but it is very important, is sort of the agricultural and medicine supply chain is very vulnerable to the heat. And, you know, a good example, I talked to my colleagues that work in Delhi, urban issues, and they tell me that, you know, when you have these urban markets and the trucks are bringing tomatoes to the market, they get queued up and it's, you know, because of traffic jams. And then with the extreme heat, without the adequate refrigeration, the food spoils before it gets to market. And it's a loss of income, but it's also then you have to throw away that food. And then guess what? That causes more methane because that, you know, that's a organic waste that gets added to the landfill. Mm-hmm. And so we are working as well on sort of innovative cooling for cold chain support and logistics support for these sorts of agriculture providers, and including, you know, some really interesting, I was at a fascinating, and getting to your, I know you're interested in technology, you know, seeing some of these technological solutions like solar-based cooling and trucks and using other sorts of sealants and organic sealants on foods to extend its sort of lifetime to get to, before it gets to market and keep it cool. So those are some... So yeah, those are some elements we're doing with India. But I think it's the key thing is really around getting there is like the element of mitigation of the heat effect, but there's also sort of the heat warning side I wanted to talk about, because you know, this is getting to the point when, you know, a lot of urban areas will have a local heat officer now, and we're coming up with, you know, what is that, what's the terms of reference for what is that job, and what kind of data can they give? You know, we have built up early warning system for storms, and now we're thinking, you know, is there something that could be replicated for heat? Because when you get heat events, you need to warn people and then have the adequate cooling shelters and sort of, and then, you know, have places where farmers and other outside workers can go to, because obviously it can be very debilitating and you know, affect their health.
Where do you see the needs of capacity building to expand this thinking?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is on what we find is that there's the data, you know, of what is the, you know, what is extreme heat and how do you define it, and sort of just tracking it and then being able to forecast it and then share that information with the public is a big gap. And so there's a data and sort of resource need there, but then the training side as well. As I say, a lot, we've been approached by more than one city where they've said, okay, I'm an urban heat officer, what do I do? You know, and what is the terms of reference? And so we have been starting to bring together some of these heat officers, sort of broker conversations about, let's share best practices and create a community of practice around what this looks like, and then provide support to them as they build that capacity.
Yeah, and then we're coming into one of my questions that I talked to you about earlier, about bureaucratic constraints. And there is a limit access to resources, technology, and adaptive infrastructure in the region. Right. And the World Bank has operated within a series of bureaucratic constraints that many say slows its delivery capacity. Is anything going to be done to change this historic criticism?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I will step back on that question to answer it in this way, because the World Bank itself is under sort of an evolution roadmap. And if you walk into the World Bank Now headquarters, as I just walked in today, it does say now on the wall, ending poverty on a livable planet, which is a change for the bank in the past couple of years. You know, we've gotten to the point now where, you know, poverty alleviation and prosperity is kind of, now we look at sustainability and our planet as, you know, kind of an equal footing, which is a great step forward for us, I think. But what that means is that, you know, how do you implement that in practice? You know, reality, that's a nice vision to have, but how do you actually do that in a country setting? What we realized is we didn't have kind of a fit for purpose. You know, we do a series of country diagnostics that kind of try to map out what countries' priorities should be and how, you know, like you said, there's limited resources, there's bureaucracy. How do you, you know, cut through that and say, okay, here are your top things you need to be doing for climate change and for development? And so to solve that problem, about 2 years ago, we launched a new country diagnostic called a Country Climate and Development Report, or a CCDR. It's a really an in-depth exercise. It takes about a year, and we cover across all sectors, across finance, we cover poverty, social protection, and all the various aspects. We bring everybody together, which it's a really interesting exercise, and a lot of debate goes on internally and externally. We consult with the client and with stakeholders in the country. But essentially what we do is we look at a country's development pathway and say, okay, where are you today? What types of development goals do you have? You know, are you poverty, you know, income levels, sectors you want to grow, jobs you want to create? We look at that and we, you know, we're kind of targeting the finance minister and saying, okay, you know, we're trying to come at your perspective. Where are you trying to go? But then we have much better models of climate change, and we say, okay, well, that's where you want to go. But then we have, now here's what climate change is going to do to that. You know, you, let's say you want to grow agricultural productivity, but you know, we are forecasting this sort of heat and or drought or, you know, variable rainfall. So you have to take that into consideration as you're trying to grow your agricultural sector. These climate resilience is going to have to be built into that. And so we look at the climate, and then we also look at, you know, the larger countries that have some emissions. We look at their emissions sort of pie chart and say, where are you today and where are you trying to go in terms of getting to net zero? Where are the opportunities for private sector? And then we kind of do some sectoral deep dives depending on the country. Sometimes it's heavily on agriculture and rural economies. Other times it's on fossil fuel transition or industrial transition. It depends on the country's development. But at the end of this process, the nice thing about it is it does cut through a lot of that bureaucracy and sort of confusion. It just comes up with a series of very targeted recommendations of, you know, we've looked at your situation. Here are the top 5 or 8 things you need to be doing in the next 5 years on the resilience front and on the mitigation front. And then here's the sort of financing you need, and here's the policy changes. And that informs our own work program, but it also helps to inform the government at all levels. And so that's one thing we're doing. I think that's a huge investment. If people are interested, I think there's like 72 of these CCDRs have been published globally for different countries. It's a great resource if you're trying to just get a handle on what is X country's, you know, priorities on climate change and what should they be doing.
Yeah, well, it is an issue related to also to governance structure and policies. If you have the right policy and governance structure in place, it will be easier for implementation. And of course, it needs also a part of leadership to drive this change. And I don't think we maybe have all the tools in place, but what I could understand that you are working with is a lot of new tools, and also innovative solutions are also on the way. And hopefully we can manage to see a bigger role for the local government to play to implement many of the needed solutions.
Yes.
But thank you, Tom. It was great to have you with me in this important talk with focus on green, innovative climate finance. But let's not stop here. Let us learn how to deliver the dynamic solutions with the involvement of private and public stakeholders with a multi-level capacity. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Kay. Really good to be with you again. And I look forward to working with you and with the local governments and all to achieve some of these solutions.
I'm Kay Embren. Follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn, where I will be announcing the future guests to this podcast. And you can expect about 2 programs a month. And each guest has a unique story of making business and society sustainable. So find out more. Visit my homepage, kayembren.org. Thank you for listening.